Thank you, Masala and Makosi. Makosi, you're dynamite, man. I just think that you're just in the wrong church. You need to come be with us in common ground. That said, you'd have to bring your husband and then you guys will kill me. But we really do honor you. It was wonderful to be with you last night, to stay in your home. And for Sue and I, we want to thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your hostility. I mean, hospitality. and then just to say, Craig and Shannon, we honor our friendship with you and grateful to God for that. And to Rob and Claire, who are new friends, just kind of connected this past few days at our camp. And Beatrice and Benson, we honor you guys and thank you for the trust to stand in this church and to bring God's word. And I want us to really be expectant that we're not ticking a box this morning around, hey, I got to church, heard a sermon. I'm really trusting that we would leave here today feeling like God has spoken to the very depths of our being and that his word is instructive and it shapes our lives. And I see myself purely, I receive the honor for all the words you use to describe me, but I see myself as just a servant of Jesus and his mission in the world. And I want to speak to you this morning on what I've called the most elusive virtue of the 21st century. Now, I know those at the camp, the leaders' camp, I spoke on the most under-celebrated fruit of the Spirit, which is patience. But today I want to speak to you about the most elusive virtue of the 21st century. I want to speak to you about contentment. And you'll know why. And this isn't like a feel-good message. It is an apostolic Bible foundational word for the depths of our being. And maybe to give a bit of context, if you live in South Africa and you were to ask, what's the dominant emotion? I used to say it's anger. In our politics, in our business world, on the roads, the dominant emotion is anger. When I think of what's happening in homes and communities, the dominant emotion I used to say was anger. I'm now wanting to say I no longer see anger as the main thing. I see discontent as the initial fault line that is fueling the emotional expression of our discontent, which overflows into anger. And so what's interesting in the book of Exodus and other repeats where the Ten Commandments are mentioned, Yahweh says, you shall have no other gods before me. And basically what's at the heart of that is if you've got Yahweh, you don't need any other gods before him. Except the last command, the tenth command, Yahweh says we should not covet another man's gold or silver, another man's slave, another man's wife, another man's houses, land. We shouldn't move boundary stones. We shouldn't be looking for other people's goods. Commandment number 1 and commandment number 10 are essentially the same commandment. The one is how we work it out before Yahweh, and the other is how we work it out on the horizontal. And every other commandment from commandment 2 to commandment 9, I'm not preaching on it today, I'm just wanting to frame something, has to do with calling us away from discontent. You shall honor your father and mother. You should keep the Sabbath day holy. Why is there this instruction to keep the Sabbath day holy? And it's don't have another God before me. Don't covet another man's goods. What's God trying to tell us in all of that? By not keeping the Sabbath day holy and getting all commercially active on that day, basically, you're saying we don't trust Yahweh. We need to work. We need to evidence the sweat of our brow. We wanna generate resources through our own efforts. And God, who himself rested on the seventh day, wants to give us a wisdom to rest from our own labors. And I don't have time to get into all of it, but I want to make the case that you can go to each of those commandments and you'll see the call to honor your father and mother is really about covenant. It's about covenant community. It's about family. It's about evidencing the fact that we are not atomized individuals all doing our own thing. God puts us in community, and that the first frontier of that is our own family, and in the community of the redeemed is this wonderful call. And God is not honored in that, and our covetous, very often, this notion of, I don't want to take responsibility for my family. So I've been telling my kids, they've got to start saving, they've got to look after me, da 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 da. No, I haven't said that. But the truth is, the parents are supposed to lay up for the children, not the children for the parents. But in a crisis, there needs to be this other covenantal thing that kicks in. And at the heart of dishonoring parents is this thing of discontent. I don't want my lifestyle interrupted with all these horrible things. Okay. You also may have heard the story of this wealthy employer who was overheard one of his employees saying these words: if I could just have 10,000 rand, I would be perfectly content. So this rich boss thought, I've never ever seen anyone perfectly content. So he walked up to her and he said, I want to give you a check for 10,000 rand. Here it is. I've never seen anybody perfectly content. Gave it to her. And as she walked away, he heard her say, I wish I'd said 20,000. What is it about us that the advertising industry knows? What is it about us that the advertising industry knows? They exploit us. In the 1950s, you'd buy soap because it would make you clean. Ads on the TVs in America, buy Lux, the soap that will make you clean. Today, buy this soap, it'll make you beautiful. Now, I was at the camp. This guy used a lot of soap, but he's still not beautiful. Sorry. The safe person to pick on is the leader. And I really, you know, advertising, I was Googling a secondhand car a while back on Gumtree. The next minute, every time I read an online newspaper, there's like a, have you seen the move, The Great Hack, or whatever it is, it's all about data, how data is being hacked. And these guys knew more about me. Our culture is exploiting us. You know what the culture does? It robs us of our self-respect, and then it sells it back to us at the price of the product. It tells you you're a loser if you don't drive a certain car. Then you get the car, and you're in debt, and you're still a loser. Basically, at the heart of this message is there's nothing external, or there's nothing that can satisfy the deepest need inside of us by external means. We have to get back to understanding that God has called us to experience his contentment. And following Jesus Christ should mark us with supernatural contentment. It'll be good for you. It'll be good for this community, and it'll be good for our mission in the world. This is a missional imperative. It's not about how do I just get over my stuff and be content in a nice little bubble. No, contentment is about you being a whole person. It's about communities being animated by contentment and joy, and we're islands of hope in a sea of despair. And it's about the way we live our lives out loud in the marketplace. People say, who are you? Where do you come from? Take me to your leader. Okay. Don't laugh at that. So the two passages I want to just comment on, we're going to see that contentment has four major marks or expressions. Contentment has a shape. Contentment, it might not be up there. We're still going to read. Oh, there we are. Contentment has a curriculum. Contentment has a range. Contentment has a secret. On your marks, get set, go. I don't know where I got that template from. Let's just move along. Read with me these passages on the screen, and let's come with hungry hearts. In Philippians 4, 10 to 13, Paul says, I rejoiced in the Lord greatly that now at length you have revived your concern for me. You were indeed concerned for me, but you had no opportunity. Not that I'm speaking of being in need. And what Paul's talking about is this partnership he had with the Philippian church, and they were supporting him financially. He says, for I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every need I have come, I can do all. I'm sorry. I should have put them on. It's small font. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I can do all things through him who strengthens me. Yeah. But now, Paul's writing to a community of Christ followers who may have had people visiting that church when that letter was being read out on a Sunday, and the people would have thought, wow, this is so different to the culture we live in, which is also just full of discontent. But then he did another letter, and he wrote it to a leader. Leaders are servants who are just more mature. They carry authority. God wants his church to have leaders. But this is interesting. Of all the things that Paul calls Timothy to, this young leader in Ephesus, he's calling him to discover contentment as something that marks his life. So he says to him, but godliness with contentment is great gain. 1 Timothy 6, it's on the screen. For we brought nothing into the world, and we cannot take anything out of the world. But if we have food and clothing, with all these we will be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation, into a snare, into many senseless and harmful desires that plunge people into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. Guys, just to get this right, God does not have a problem with money. He doesn't probably have a problem with wine. He doesn't have a problem with sex. He doesn't have a problem with anything. He just has a problem with people. All of these things are good gifts of a gracious God that we need to steward within the context of wisdom and joyful liberty, that they must build community, not break community. But this notion of some people get Gnostic, like, oh, money, careful of money. If you feel like that, please hang around with me. I'll take all your money off you. I want to help you. It's, listen carefully, it's this idolatry, having gods before God. It's being covetous in relation to this. So it's the love of money. It's misplaced love. It's misguided. It's abnormal affection for it, he says. So the love of money, when it gets you, is the root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. Pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, and gentleness. These passages that we read are like an MRI or MR, what do you call it? MRI scan for the soul. Every now and then we need our souls audited. I don't know what's going on in your soul. And you don't know what's going on in my soul. But I tell you, when we read these passages, the blazing light of God's truth starts to illuminate. And this is life-giving, what you're going to hear today. This is not, those scans are not designed to humiliate you, expose you. They're designed to help you to know what's going wrong on the inside. Where's your discontent coming from? What's gnawing at the depths of your being? So we're going to hit the first one. And by the way, this is really, I found this very humorous. For about 3 or 4 months, Sue and I have been, or maybe 6 months, we've been camping around this and saying we're wanting to simplify our lives in some measures. We've made some decisions around still living a joyful, gracious, celebratory life, but we've wanted to learn to just downscale a little for the glory of God. We're not in the dentist chair having root canal treatment. We just think less is sometimes better. And when we discover that, it's so beautiful and life-giving. So when Paul writes this letter to the Philippians, he's writing from a Roman prison. He's probably chained to a Roman guard. Now, what's unusual about that? You can say, oh, wow. Yeah, that's just, isn't Paul a great guy? He's learning how to be content while he's chained to a prisoner. No, what's even more unusual about that is the last time Paul was in Philippi, he's writing from a Roman prison. The last time he was in Philippi, he was in the Philippian jail. And when he was in that jail, persecuted for his faith, with Silas, and they'd been beaten on their backs, and they were singing songs in the night, and as they go into a sleep, there's this violent earthquake that shakes all the prison gates, all the chains fall off, everyone's freed in a moment. Now, Paul's in prison now in a Roman prison. Why has God not sent an earthquake? That's the problem, is some people want all our satisfaction and our deliverance to be external. What God does from time to time externally in supernatural ways is beautiful. But I'll tell you what's more beautiful. It's when you can be chained to a Roman guard and you can write letters that we're reading 2,000 years later this morning and we're gleaning the wisdom of that. That is powerful. That is transforming. That is changing communities. All an earthquake does is show that God's in charge. But it doesn't necessarily come with all the wonderful wisdom that he brings. So contentment has a shape, number one. There's a study out of Duke University in America, and I was fascinated by this. These are secular guys. They found the factors that contribute to emotional and mental stability. At last, they've discovered what are the things that really essentially build contentment in your life. And number one, and not on the screen, it's the absence of suspicion and resentment. This is totally secular. When you got over your rubbish, when you've learned to heal your relationships, it's an amazing thing. Number two, living in the past. Unwholesome preoccupations with past stuff. I love the illustration of God. When we drive a motor car, the windscreen is way bigger than the rearview mirror. We're supposed to be moving forward with an honor on the past, looking to the past, learning from the past, but it is not where we're going. We are not going to the past. We're going into the future. And these guys have said, hey, people who are really content are not living in the past because they're too busy seeing the new day, limping with regret and lament from the past. Thirdly, they're not wasting time and energy fighting conditions you cannot change. Sometimes we just have to cooperate with life, even if it's brokenness, even in the political turmoil of our country, even in the economic uncertainty. There's not one thing you can do personally to change that. So sometimes we've got to work with it and trust God and be a community that's part of the solution in the midst of the despair. Fourthly, force yourself to stay involved in the living world. Don't withdraw and become hermits and reclusive and say, oh, we're not going out there. It's a really dangerous, puffy world out there. We're not going to expose ourselves to the germs, figuratively speaking. No, no. You get out into the world, take your song there, and live out your faith. I mean, this is a secular study, but I think it's fantastic. Fifthly, refuse to indulge in self-pity when life hands you a ordeal. Sixthly, cultivate old-fashioned values like love, humor, compassion, loyalty, patience, and hospitality. Seventhly, do not expect too much of yourself. I found that fascinating. Because they said the gap between self-expectation and your ability to realize that sometimes is just so wide. What about just being content with who God made you to be and just live out your life? Because if you don't have that, you'll live a life of inadequacy. You keep saying, be realistic, be sober about who you are. But here's the biggest one around this thing of shape. These guys at Duke University said, people who found peace of mind and contentment, they found something bigger than themselves to believe in. So let me just say this. If you don't have God at the center of your life, what have you got?
You've got you. And would you say to a four-year-old child in front of a 747 Boeing, hey, won't you just fly this thing? You'd never do that because that Boeing is totally out of range of that child's competency level, maturity levels. I want to say to you, life is too complicated for any one of us to say, I can manage this thing on my own. I can do it my way. That is Frankie Sinatra's theme song of hell. I can do it my way. Self-autonomy is killing us. More than that, it's exhausting us. And we've got to get to the end of ourselves to get to the beginning of God. You see, ego is the acronym for edging God out. And we're in a culture that has done that. And we want is loving, vibrant, joyful people who found God at the center of their life, because that is the source of contentment. There's nothing in this life, you included, that can do that. And what he says, and that's what Paul's saying, he's saying, I can do all things through Christ. You see, the shape that God has put into every one of our hearts is cruciform. It's designed to have its fullest expression in you, to make you the most vibrant, forgiven, transformed human being through the working of the cross of Jesus Christ in your life. The good news of Jesus Christ doesn't just get to your street address. It gets to the depths of who you are. Christ in you, the hope of glory. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 5, the writer says, keep your life free from the love of money or any other thing that competes with God, and be content with what you have, for he has said, I will never leave you nor forsake you. You see, you need someone bigger than you, but you need somebody better than you. You need someone who's got the perfect track record, the one who gate crashes history, coming after rebels, and he turns them into friends. The one who comes and takes orphans and makes them his own sons and daughters. But he doesn't just put their name in a book. The writer of the book comes and lives his perfect, holy life, his empowering life. I can do all things through Christ. Folk, Christ is God's gift to the world to strengthen us on the inside. When you realize that Christ is in you, then like Paul, he's living off that shape. He says, when there's plenty and there's little, it doesn't matter. I've got Christ. I want to ask you, is Jesus enough for you? Is he still enough for you? Or is it Jesus plus? Is it Jesus plus all the other stuff? Are you saying in your way you relate to God, I would be really happy if Jesus indwelt me, or if I have all these other stuffs added in my life? And God's not out to pleasure-proof our life. He is so kind. He's so generous. He opens his hands. He just wants us to have the right stuff at the center. And the one who comes to live in Paul, who comes to live in Timothy, who comes to live in the readers, who's living in us in this room, is the one who comes and fills the shape. The one who loves you the most, knows you the best. He says, I want to be to you what only I can be to you. I want to deliver you from you and every other pretender. So, what have we dealt with? Point number one, contentment has a... Thank you for the two or three of you. There's an all-expenses-paid trip to Mauritius. For those of you that want to come in, too late. We're going to... Nkandla. if you want to get in first, you can have that one. I'm just teasing. Okay, number two. Curriculum has a... Just want to check. Contentment has its own curriculum. Contentment has its own curriculum, my dear friends. Just listen carefully to this. For I have learned. Say learned. Sounds like we're in a curriculum there. Sounds like we're in a process. Doesn't sound like you've arrived. He says, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. I've learned the secret. You see, the gospel gives you peace with God instantaneously, the work of the cross. He removes the hostility in our relationship. Holy God, sinful man. He removes it instantly, makes me his own, indwells me, fills me with his son. But then he teaches me progressively to learn contentment. You don't have the totality of contentment. If he says, I've learned. And if you keep following Paul, he's learning, present continuous, this whole secret. And there are a few things we must learn in this curriculum, and some of them are in the text, some of them are just some of my own thoughts. Lesson one, what will satisfy you and I eternally? Think about it. What will satisfy us eternally ought to be the thing that satisfies us now. Because when we get there, it's going to be embarrassing. Because whatever's satisfying you now won't be there. Bigger, better, faster, all that won't be there. Enjoy them in this life. It's like chewing gum. Enjoy the flavor, spit it out. It's not going to satisfy you. Chewing gum, bubble gum, whatever you call it. And I think too many Christ followers are suffering from what we call eternity amnesia. They don't have that day in mind. Martin Luther says there's 2 days in my calendar. There's today and that day. And I do everything today against the backdrop of that day. And you can be certain that that day is when God has the final word, when Jesus Christ wraps up human history and he says, gentlemen, it's closing time. He's in charge. Lesson two, true contentment celebrates what you have. It's not lamenting what you don't have. Too many people who you hear, look at the bra conversations and the hanging out and coffee bars and just measure. What are we saying? It's that thing we don't have, that elusive thing that is eating us up, and we've got to train ourselves to start thanking God for what we do have. We've got health, we've got great relationships. My daughter here in the front row. She's actually my wife, guys. Believe it or not, a guy like this with silver hair can have a girl like that. Wow. Third lesson is don't overestimate money's power and subtle promises. Don't overestimate money's power and its subtle promises. It overpromises and underdelivers. And Pleasure's law of diminishing returns goes like this. The amount of money you needed to spend to get X amount of a fix, happiness or contentment. All that changes if you're looking in the wrong place. You're just paying more and more and more to get less and less and less. It's pleasure's law of diminishing return. You don't need money. You don't need money for contentment. You need money to pay the bills. You need money for your day-to-day things. And God has promised to give you everything that you need for life and godliness. Paul says, for the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It is through this craving that some have wandered from the faith and pierced themselves with many pangs. But as for you, O man of God, flee these things. As for you, mature believer, flee these things. Don't chase money, rather chase righteousness, pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, steadfastness, gentleness. And that's what happens. The gospel gives us Christ. And with Christ comes a new pursuit. We aim a little bit higher. If not, it's going to let you down. God in his love and faithfulness will make sure it lets you down. He says that even some have experienced great sorrow. He says some people eager for money have pierced themselves with many griefs. You can get a broken heart. All these get-rich-quick schemes, all these prosperity gospels. I believe in biblical prosperity because God is so good and he's not broke. but this notion of churches that bend the gospel toward getting rich is heresy. And I might not get invited back, but I'm just going to say that. Money is a great servant. It's a terrible master. There's the story of a man who once saw this bald eagle soaring in circles. The circles began to tighten, and the man looked over to see a weasel. Suddenly, the eagle dropped out of the sky like a jet and caught the weasel in its talons. Amazingly, as the eagle began to fly away, the weasel began to eat away at the breast of that eagle. The man watched as the weasel tore away at the eagle, snapping bones and chewing flesh. He watched the eagle fold up and crash. And the weasel bounced off on the rocks and went on his way. Be careful of what you want. Sometimes it can ruin you. And sometimes we're so desperate, it eats us. It hurts us. I've been in seasons of my life where I've realized that there's some other things before God. I've realized that I'm coveting stuff. It's that, and a telltale sign. I was talking to a friend of mine recently, just as you start waking up in the morning and the first thought is this other thing. Something's eating you. You're not feasting on the goodness of God, the assurance of his promises. It says some have even wandered from the faith, or they've lost their moorings. Some people eager for money, or that guy, or that girl, or that house, or that reputation, so eager to buy it. They've fallen into temptation and a trap and into many foolish and harmful desires. And then the big one, and then we'll go into the other two quite quickly. You cannot keep what you do gain in this life. Have you ever seen a hearse with a trailer? No? Like, I'm dead, but I'm taking stuff with me. Paul made it very clear. You brought nothing into the world, and you take nothing out of this world. Your true prosperity is the kind of person you've become. And the kind of person you become is one that God is wanting to be marked by deep, satisfying contentment. And so really what Paul's trying to tell us is that when in terms of contentment as a shape, it's not the practice of a technique, it's the presence of a person, Jesus Christ. When he says contentment has a curriculum, it's following the most content person in the universe, Jesus himself. And being ravished by his wisdom. Third thing, contentment has a range. Notice what Paul says, I know how to be brought low and I know how to abound. Just imagine in your mind, there's a pole, positive pole, negative pole. And he's saying, I know how to abound, positive. And he says, I know how to be brought low. I know how to have plenty. I know how to be in want. He says, in any and every, say any and every. In any and every circumstance, this curriculum also has a range. He says this, in any and every circumstance, I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, positive, and hunger. He lived his life, a true Christ follower will experience both dimensions of plenty and want. And if you never, ever experience want, I feel desperately sorry for you. Because you will never learn the secret of contentment. You will never ever know what it's like to be content by drawing on Jesus internally, because your contentment will be based on, oh, I'm really content. Look at this positive pole. No, he says, I've learned the secret in any and every situation when it's fantastic and when it's really, really challenging. How many of you can identify that with that as the reality of your life? You are between those two poles, and you sometimes can camp at one pole for a longer period, and then God in his mercy brings you to another, or vice versa. He humbles you when you get too dependent on the stuff, and then he just says, look, I'm not mean, but I hate competition. I want to be God in your life. So sometimes he just removes the stuff that we're worshiping? And everybody said, yeah. Yeah. Paul says, in that same passage, he tells these, he's teaching on contentment. He says, rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. The foundation for a life of joy is having Christ being in the curriculum and experiencing the range of discipleship that transforms us and makes us beautifully empowered followers of the wisest, most loving being in the universe. Contentment is not the state of your accounts. It's the state of your heart. Contentment is found in making the most of least and rejoicing between both poles. That's maturity. We're not mature if we're always spitting the dummy and always talking about how cruel life is to us and complaining about things. Last one, then we're going to pray. Am I okay on time? Okay, so I could take up another offering. It's not that good, eh? That's what the prosperity guys do. Oh, the guy preached so well, we're going to take up another offering. I don't think you guys will do that. I can't practice that trick. I just want you to sigh and relax. I just want you to feel like we're on this little journey together. Let's just say it again. Contentment has a? Contentment has a? Contentment has a? Contentment has a secret. Oh, my dear. I'm so embarrassed to tell you that I only found this out last year. In all my reading of the Bible over 40 years of being a Christ follower, I only discovered this recently. Let me just say something. When Paul had that thorn in his flesh and he was asking the Lord to deliver him from this like agony of circumstances. And he asked him three times, and the Lord said to him, what? My? Have you ever thought that like when God gives you grace, it's like a consolation prize? It's like God gives you grace, or he gives you grace when you don't get what you really want. Like grace is the B prize. And what happens is when you hear Paul say, I've learned the secret of being content. It sounds like, suck it up, Paul. I've learned the secret, and it's have white knuckles, grind your teeth. Huh? Does that sound particularly appealing? Have you also realized, like a friend of mine was saying, they were driving behind a high ace taxi van the other day, and there is Philippians 4:13 in the back. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Yay! Do you believe that? You can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. It's like I'm about to write my matric exams, students among us. And you study and you go in there and you say, I can do this thing. Huh? Or we're going to go and do our driver's license test. And somebody gives you this verse, I can do all things. And then if you fail the test and the driving exam, what happens? That's why we've got to see contentment in the riverbanks of range, whether I pass or fail. And the thing I learned that I hadn't really seen, I'm embarrassed to tell you this, but I want to invite you into this little lesson. And you theologians here, you can come and tell me I got it wrong, but we can arrange for your excommunication as well. Here's the deal, guys. When Paul says, I've learned the secret, let's get it. He says, I've learned the secret. Or he says, I can do all things through him who strengthens me. What's the secret? What's the secret? Is it a fridge magnet? Is it that prayer? Is it a immature little badge we put on life? Is it magic? He says, I've learned the secret. If we read on, whether in plenty, in want, whatever, in every, I've learned the secret. I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. Here's what I learned that I didn't realize. Is that promise, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, is married to I've learned the secret to be content. Contentment is the strengthening presence of the resurrected Jesus Christ in our lives. It's Jesus in the cockpit of the 747 jumbo. It's not Rigby Wallace. I don't have enough wisdom. You honored me by saying I'm wise, but I'll tell you what I learned early in my life. I'm not wise enough to lead this life. I need Jesus Christ. That's why I'm in His Word, under His Word, under the Spirit, in prayer, in community. I want to be exposed to every single means of grace that Jesus can bring to my life. And in that place, I learn the secret. I can do everything through Christ who strengthens me, whether I'm over here. Christ is strengthening me. Whether I'm over here, Christ is strengthening me. And when you've got Christ, you got everything. And if that's the ultimate reality there, it's the ultimate reality now. Let's give the Lord a hand of appreciation. Let's just thank Him. It's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. It's so wonderful. Do you want that or earthquakes? You want to be delivered? Or do you want a relationship of moment by moment interaction with the one who loves you the most, knows you the best, wants your, the gift of your dependence? Wow. So when Paul says, godliness with contentment is great gain, that's not a consolation prize. That is the most beautiful kind of life we can live. Godliness, a God-centered life, a fully occupied heart by Jesus Christ, and the contentment that flows from His presence. In that is great gain. If you got that, you are richer than a billionaire. Money can't buy that. All the money in the world can't buy that. Human effort can't generate it. It's a gift of God's grace. Comes to us in the person of Jesus Christ. And it's great gain for you personally. It's great gain for a community of contentment when these fault lines are screaming at this moment in our history. We can sing a little louder. We can love a little deeper. We're secure. Nothing can take this away from you. And then it's great gain for us missionally, because it's the most elusive quality in the world. When it's real, when it's authentic, when it's lived out in our day-to-day relationships, it's contagious. It's powerful. People will think, hang on, you're either on drugs or you're a Christ follower, because you can't generate this stuff. It's not, you can't medicate your way into this. It's a working of God's grace. And so we look to Christ today. Lift our eyes a little bit freshly over the noise in our culture, over the noise in the economy, over sometimes feelings of insecurity over here. The beautiful thing of community is that in community, there are always some people over here and there are always some people over there. But when you're together, grace flows toward each other in the most life-giving way. I hope you can feel the affections of Jesus Himself that I carry in my heart for you today. I have not come to try and entertain you. I've come to build something in you that I think is part of what God is wanting to do in this moment in our history. God, I want to thank You for these amazing people. I want to thank You for the leaders in this church. I want to thank You for all those that are involved in ministry. I want to thank You for our guests and our friends this morning who are sitting next to us, alongside of us. We just want to pray over all the noise of life, that we'd start to hear the whispers of the Holy Spirit as You work in us, as You transform us, as You shape us for the glory of God. Pray for Grace Generation Church, Lord, that she would be defined as a chosen lady, glowing with the beauty and the wonder of contentment, of God's peace flowing through the riverbanks of ordinary lives, displaying the sufficiency of Christ. Jesus, You're the hero of the story, and we give you praise today. Amen.